This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Days before he invaded Poland, Adolf Hitler is reported to have said, "Who today speaks, after all, of the annihilation of the Armenians?" Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we hear about the century's first genocide, the Turkish massacre of Armenians in 1915. Our guest is Peter Balakian. He is the author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Black Dog of Fate, An American Son Uncovers His Armenian Past. The book is the winner of the Penn Martha Allbrand Award for the Art of the Memoir. Listeners, you're welcome to join the conversation. If you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, our phone number, 333-9455. If you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Peter Balakian is professor of English at Colgate University and the author of four books of poetry, most recently Dyer's Thistle. His memoir, Black Dog of Fate, is now out in paperback from Broadway Books. Again, your questions and comments are invited. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Peter Balakian, good afternoon. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Celeste. Good to be here.
Many, if not most of us, know little or nothing of the genocide of 1915. Tell us what happened.
Well, I'll try to compress a large history lesson the best I can. I think it's important to understand that acts of genocide are always complex, that they are the product of a combination of forces, social, economic, ideological, historical. The fundamental facts of the Armenian genocide revolve around 1915. On April 24, 1915, the Turkish government commenced its final solution for the Armenians. And it's important to understand that the Armenians were the major Christian minority living under Ottoman Turkish rule at the time, and historically, along with the Greeks and the Assyrians, these were the three major Christian populations living under Turkic rule, and all fared very badly. It was not easy living under Turkish rule if you were Christian. Among the ideological contexts for the genocide, I think it's important to focus on the fact that Christians were deemed infidels, and therefore living under Turkic Muslim law, and therefore weren't permitted access to many of the privileges that Muslims were. And this had already in some way dehumanized Armenians and all the Christians. Armenians were also living on their historic homeland, and as the Ottoman Empire began to fall apart, this Christian minority became an easy scapegoat. And out of what we might say the crumbling years of the Ottoman Empire arose something that is not uncommon in genocidal episodes, that is an ideology that was advocating racial purity, and in this case it was called Pan-Turkism, evolved, and not unlike Hitler's Aryanism in Nazi Germany. And the idea was that if you could rid your country of the impure peoples, that is the non-Turkic peoples and the Armenians in particular, you could revitalize your nation. And so the Armenian genocide was implemented with this ideology, and between 1915 and 1917, about 1.5 million Armenians were exterminated, and another 1 million or so were completely sent into permanent exile. And so what was a 2,500-year-old civilization was completely erased. And what was left of Armenia would be on the other side of the border in the Russian Empire. And, of course, that still survives today. So with all of this enormous duress and strife and suffering, Armenia does still exist on the map. And there are very few cultures that ancient in that part of the world that still do exist on the map.
Hmm. Why has the Armenian genocide been all but forgotten?
Well, again, I think there are a number of factors here, and I think there's some ironies as well. I want to point out one of the salient ironies, that in its day, the plight of Armenia and then the genocide itself represented the first major international human rights crisis that the rising United States got involved in. Between 1894, when the Friends of Armenia Society was founded by Julia Ward Howe in Boston as a response to the first wave of massacres, which were done by the last Sultan, Abdul Hamid, and took the lives of almost 300,000 Armenians in the 1890s, at that moment, Americans began to mobilize to try to save Armenia. And again, during the genocide, the Near East Relief Foundation raised $30 million for genocide refugees in an age when a loaf of bread cost a nickel. This is an extraordinary commitment from the United States, and I think it shows the United States in a very good light, at least for a while. It's also worth remembering that the Armenian genocide was covered in the press in dramatic and bold ways, week in and week out, between 1915 and 1918. And I, again, ironically, much more dramatically than the Holocaust was covered. So that we go from this moment of enormous focus, and it was Herbert Hoover who said that Armenia is probably as well known as England is to the United States popular culture during this period. So we go from this enormous, awareness to a black hole in memory. And I think the reason for the black hole in memory, again, is two or threefold. You know, first, I think it's important that people understand that the Turkish government, the perpetrators, have done everything they can do to try to silence this story, to deny it, to deny their responsibility for the genocide of the Armenians, and to actually come to the United States and blackmail, coerce, and pressure the State Department and other powerful institutions into not telling or letting this story come through. So as early as 1935, the Turkish government succeeded in prevailing on FDR's State Department to stop MGM from making what would have been the first Armenian genocide film, which was to be based on Franz Werfel's best-selling novel of those years, The 40 Days of Musa Dagh. So Turkish denial has been an obstruction, but it's not the sole reason. I think that after 1922, when the Armenian question, as it was called, was abandoned by the West, that the United States turned into a kind of isolationist phase in the 20s and into the late 30s. And I think that this act happened at an early part of the 20th century, a good several decades, or at least a few decades, before genocide as a concept was more universally understood.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, Raphael Lemkin didn't coin the phrase until 1944, that is the phrase, the term genocide, and he coined it with the Armenian massacres as his main example of what he meant, and the Assyrian massacres as well. And of course, he was beginning to respond to what was happening to the Jews of Europe. But so the Human Rights Genocide Convention, UN Genocide Convention, is 1948. And it really isn't until the 60s, I think, in the United States, that a burgeoning human rights discourse and movement evolves, in part from the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, feminism, and the Holocaust studies discourse. But here the Armenians have been sort of outside of a public discourse for these decades. And now, mm-hmm. I think in the 60s and 70s, they were able to hook in and have a more social discourse, a public discourse in the United States. But there was this long lag time.
Yeah. What role did Armenia, did the Soviet Union having control over Armenia for so long play in the silence?
Yeah, I think that's another very good point. And that is that, just again, to fill in on some history, I would say after 1922, Armenia joins the Soviet Union. It had been independent for a couple of years in the aftermath of World War One and the genocide. And then, of course, it becomes a republic of the Soviet Union, and it loses any sense of, global voice.
Yeah.
So there's no state, there's no global voice, and all you, what you do have is a shell-shocked diasporan community which is trying to reorganize itself after this extraordinary inferno that it's passed through. And it's true, during the Stalin years, there would be very little access to an Armenian voice from the Soviet Union. That thawed a little in the 60s and 70s. In fact, the Soviets under Khrushchev allowed the Armenians to build an extraordinary genocide memorial, and it exists today in the capital, Yerevan, and it's very, very powerful.
Hmm. You believe it would be in Turkey's best interest to acknowledge what happened.
Right.
How do you make that case?
Well, I mean, you know, everybody else makes it. I mean, from Elie Wiesel to Arthur Miller and Norman Mailer, everybody I talk to about this, to senators and congressmen, say the same thing. They can't understand why Turkey will not own up to its past, and especially in the situation where it has a very easy distance from the Ottoman period, mm-hmm. from the last phase of the Ottoman Empire when this atrocity was committed. And I think we've seen Germany do this with, you know, a certain amount of honesty and conscience, distancing itself but not absolving itself from the Third Reich. And I think it would help. Turkey is always complaining that the West doesn't like Turkey, and I think that Turkey is somehow misstating the issue as always being about anti-Muslim feelings. It's so clear that Turkey's problems are inseparable from its human rights record. The Turkish government leads the world today in imprisoned writers and journalists ahead of Syria and China. That's a Penn International report. It is targeted for practices of torture, and now torturing children has become a primary concern, and this comes from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch every year. Books are banned in Turkey all the time. Books on the Armenian genocide or on the extermination of the Greeks from the Pontus or the burning of Smyrna or the treatment of the Kurds are prohibited in Turkey, and this creates the clear understanding in the West that Turkey does not have any democratic processes and it has no ability to create a self-critical environment about its culture and its past. And I think in some way this all begins with the genocide of the Armenians. Mm-hmm. If Turkey could free itself up and begin to critically examine itself and not punish its people for doing so, it would begin to join a more modern democratic idea of the West. But I fear that that Turkey needs to inspect what fanatical nationalism can do to a country, and I fear it's right now locked in that.
Mm. Well, of course, if it was to acknowledge what happened, then it would... We would be at a point then where Turkey could look at itself more critically, its present-day situation.
Oh, that's true. I think these things are all intimately connected. You know, again, critics, you know, there are hundreds of scholars around the United States who include people from Henry Louis Gates and Cornel West to Holocaust scholars like Robert J. Lifton, Raoul Hilberg, and Yehuda Bauer, who are asking Turkey to please make this step, to take this step, that the results can only be positive. I mean, it is hard to believe that given the magnitude of this crime, that the Turkish government hasn't even shown an ounce of concern for the Armenian people. And again, I think we're in a climate in the 90s here as we approach the end of the century where we see so much healthy apology from President Clinton apologizing for slavery on his recent trip in Africa, to the Canadian government apologizing for its treatment of its Native Americans and reimbursing them with some token kind of compensation. the Catholic Church in France, the Vatican responding to the Holocaust with a sense of penance, and I think this is part of a humane and democratic process which the planet very much needs.
Mm. How did your family, the family members who survived, how did they survive? Who survived?
Well, of course, I grew up, as you know from my memoir, I grew up in a family with a secret.
Right.
Nobody could talk about what haunted them most, which was 1915. And my grandmother, on August 1st, 1915, was put on a death march in her home city of Diyarbakir, an ancient Armenian city named after the great first century B.C., King Dikran, and a city that is now part of Turkey and sadly a place where many Kurds are being killed. But my grandmother was put on a death march there with her first husband and her two little girls, her infant baby, who was a 2-month-old, and her 2-year-old daughter, my aunts Alice and Gladys. They're both still living today. And the rest of her family was executed, everybody except one half-brother who had already left for the United States. Her mother, father, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, from 2-year-olds to 80-year-olds. They were all killed. And she survived the death march with her two daughters. Her first husband did not. And when she reached Aleppo later in 1915, in the fall of 1915 sometime, she did a remarkable thing. Here, this genocide widow, stripped of everything, of land, of people, of possessions, of family, all their houses, they were wealthy silk merchants, all their lands and orchards were confiscated. Here, this woman, living in the famine-ravaged refugee quarter of Aleppo, began compiling a human rights suit against the Turkish government by collecting affidavits, and then filed that suit in Newark, New Jersey, in 1920. So I think it represents an extraordinary act of courage and what I would call bearing witness. My father's side of the family was also decimated, but they probably lost a few less lives than my mother's side of the family. But again, we have to remember that, you know, almost 60% of the Armenian population was wiped out. So there is not an Armenian on the planet who hasn't been affected by the genocide.
Yeah. Your grandmother would tell stories when you were a child to you. And as you say in the book, it turned out that you were her witness. But these stories were very cryptic and,
right,
and really hard to figure out. Would you give us an example of a story that she would tell you?
Well, yeah, I would just and preface that by saying that while my grandmother didn't speak openly about the event, about the death march, about the whole genocide experience, she did, I came to understand, relay to me in ways that I came to see as encoded ways. She did transmit the trauma of this experience. She, of course, trauma is the aftermath of the catastrophe, and it doesn't go away, even if you try hard to repress it. And so, you know, I came to see in some sense that my book, as I was writing it, was becoming a book about the transmission of trauma across generations. Well, you know, my grandmother would tell me parables and folk tales and even sometimes gallows parables, and they embodied the richness of an Armenian folkloric imagination, and I was a kid just listening, often bewildered by them, excited by them because they were rich in imagination and symbols, and sometimes a little frightened by them. But the folk tale that gives my book its title, Black Dog of Fate, is a tale my grandmother told me when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, baking with her as I often did in the kitchen after Little League practice. And the tale, just to summarize it, is about a rich woman and a poor woman who have to go and call on fate, because everybody must call on fate once in their life. And the rich woman goes to call on fate, and she dresses up, you know, fabulously, and has a huge offering of lamb and jewels and so on, all kinds of exotic food she brings to fate, and fate comes to the door and just tells her to go away. And then the poor woman, who has nothing, and goes out and finds a dead black dog in a field and brings it as an offering to fate, is embraced by fate. And it becomes, that becomes a parable that I begin to ask my grandmother what it means, mm-hmm. and we have a conversation, and that becomes a parable that I ask the reader to use as a kind of thread to pull through the book and see how it plays out.
Yeah. Also, your grandmother apparently often or always when she told a story, she would say, a long time ago there was and there wasn't.
That's right. Jamanagingar Uchagar in Armenian. My Armenian's not too good, but yes, that was a kind of invocation. And it was a ritual for the storyteller, and that's an ancient Armenian insignia. And those things stay with you. Even though I did not learn Armenian growing up, I picked things up around the house, and that was something you picked up.
Mm. You write in Black Dog of Fate, you came to realize that my grandmother's stories were part of time and not part of time, part of place and not part of place. Part of the stuff that is stored in the mind's honeycomb.
That's right.
Really, very, very lovely.
Thank you.
How did you come to that realization, and when did this realization flower for you?
Well, it flowered for me. It began to flower for me as a young writer. In my early 20s, as I was working on poems, the poems that would end up in my first book, which came out in 1979, a book called Father Fisheye, I really stumbled, maybe not accidentally, maybe everything has its fate and destiny, but I stumbled into writing, digging into the family, into family things, into the past, into my own memory. And my memory seemed inseparable from my grandmother. She was my only grandparent, and her presence in my life was huge in that sense. She was something out of time, as well as mm-hmm. something so basic as your mother or father. You know, she was always there. But she was connected to this other world. She was this other world. This place that nobody wanted to talk about openly, this place that immigrants often call the old country. So my grandmother was all that, and as a writer in my early 20s, beginning to write poems, and just finding that I wanted to find language that might bring her presence back, not in any way that I thought of then as political or historical, just personal, I found that she started resonating with things bigger than I was. You know, a big previousness was starting to come from that little quest that you make with your early poems. And then I began to understand something about her stories. I began learning more about her. And finally, there's a certain point, and I recount this in my book, when I'm in my mid-20s and I'm traveling in Europe, and my aunt Gladys, with my two aunts, mm-hmm. Gladys and Lucille, and my aunt Gladys, who was the oldest on the death march, begins to tell me for the first time what happened. And that has a huge effect on me. It begins to open up a whole reality for me, and I find this very exciting for my poems. So it was really as a poet that I started understanding that my grandmother was both mythic in that sense and absolutely my blood and flesh.
Mm. To what extent do you think you owe your grandmother your life's work? I think there's a real thread there. It's a big, maybe it's a big, 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 big thick thread.
My younger sister, the youngest of us, my sister, who's the fourth of us, Janet, she's a playwright and a professor of American literature, always kids me about that. You know, she says, without Granny, what would you do? And I say, well, Janet, you know, I'm a writer, and I would be writing, because writers have to write. So I don't know what I'd be writing about, but I'd be somebody else anyway. But so I can't, you know, play omniscient on that. But all I can say is that clearly, my grandmother, as a force and a source and a nurturer, in a very basic way, she had no idea what she was doing to me. Fully, but of course, she has been hugely important to my work, and always will be, no matter what I go on to write about.
I also want the audience to know that she just sounds like just a marvelous woman. She loved rock and roll and baseball, and she followed, you know,
the Yankees.
The Yankees.
Yeah.
Casey Stengel.
That's right.
And she also kept up with the stock market.
Right.
She was a remarkable woman.
She really, she loved American culture with a passion. And, you know, I mentioned this in my book, brief, just in passing, that when my two aunts were going to take her to Europe in 1950, they got all ready, they had their tickets, it was going to be a big, you know, cruise, big old, the way we used to take those big liners across the Atlantic. And at the last minute, my grandmother backed out. She said, look, I'm never leaving this country. I'm safe here. And I think that's a powerful statement about, you know, both America and also just about trauma and how it affects survivors.
My grandparents on my father's side were from Ireland. And my grandmother never went back. And she didn't talk about it. It was really hard. There was a large family, and they were orphaned. And most of them came to America.
Did they live? They lived through the independence struggle then, I would gather. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to have to now look into my own history, thanks to your book.
I'm glad.
But, yeah, and she was so proud to be an American.
Well, you know, as you talk about Irish culture, I would just say that Seamus Heaney and I, and we've been friends for a long time, and we always joke about the Irish and the Armenians being counterparts of each other on the cusps, the far cusps of Europe. One Christian culture out there on the eastern cusp and Irish culture there on the western cusp, and both having very interesting parallels in their history. So I always feel very close to things Irish. In fact, I teach a course on Yeats here, and I take my students to Ireland every 4 or 5 years for a Yeats trip.
How has the book been received from Americans who are second or third generation?
Second or third generation
American.
Armenian American? Or anything?
Anything.
Yeah. Well, I think it's been very exciting for me to see the way this book is, as one of the reviews said, an essential American story as well as an Armenian story, because it does cut into a process of Americanization and of acculturation and of double culturedness that I think many Americans experience, whether they be Irish or Polish or Ukrainian or Chinese or Hispanic or, you know, African American. So I'm finding lots of bells ringing as I go around the country, and I'm happy to say that I've been receiving a lot of mail in which people are talking in some detail about their own histories and their own families, and it's been delightful.
And how has your family received this book?
Well, I would say for the most part, fabulously, affirmatively. But, you know, when you write a memoir about your family, you probably can't please everybody. And everybody should know that. There are going to be some people who feel that that's not how they are.
And that's not what happened.
Right.
You know, this little episode. No, that's not what happened.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's some, you know, there has been a little bit of that, but mostly it's been very, very affirmative. And I think that the memoir has been healing for a lot of people in the family, because there's been a lot of pain bottled up, and now there's a sense of release and catharsis.
Mm-hmm. What led your aunts to tell?
Well, I was beginning to poke around in the murky past,
mm-hmm.
and I think they were sensing that. I mean, they had seen a poem or two I had written that had come out in a magazine or journal, and some poems that were beginning to show these resonances of my grandmother in my memory of my childhood. And I was in my mid-20s, and we were traveling together, just the three of us, for a couple weeks in France. And I think they probably sensed I was old enough. I think there had been a lot of sense of protection in my family, that you don't want the kids to know about things this obscene and painful and horrible. And finally, some of that sense of protectiveness began to wear off. And I think they came to a point where they needed to talk as well. So a lot of these things have to do with timing,
mm-hmm.
I find.
Mm-hmm. You write that your grandmother, these are your words, must have felt that emotional economy was a necessity. But she was not repressing. She was, I guess I would use the word surviving.
Right.
And she was protecting you and her children.
Yeah, and herself,
I think. And herself.
I think the term that many psychiatrists use is psychic numbing is a useful one here. I think that survivors do need to call on a kind of numbing process so that they can move forward. And I think that was true in my grandmother's case. Again, right after the event, she bore witness by filing this suit.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when the suit didn't go anywhere, because there was no world ready to receive a human rights suit in 1920, you know, I guess she could either implode or, you know, bite the bullet and just embrace a new life in a new country, which she did. She remarried, had two more daughters, my mother being fourth, the last, and, you know, went on to have a, fruitful life, although not without a moment or two of intruding trauma. I do recount that episode in 1941, where my grandmother has not spoken about the genocide for a couple of decades, and then when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor,
mm-hmm.
in 1941, my grandmother has a complete breakdown. And we would call that today, of course, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And she, for her, the genocide is happening again.
Mm-hmm.
And she told her children that the Turks were coming, mm-hmm. and it didn't matter. She said, it doesn't matter what you do. She would tell them every day, you can do anything you want. And this is coming from a very protective mother. You can do anything you want because we're going to be dead very soon. The Turks are coming.
Yeah.
And then she had a complete breakdown, went into depression, and only electroshock therapy was able to pull her out of it. So except for that, she numbed pretty well and went forward. And again, I think this is true of Holocaust survivors and war survivors and so on. You do find certain patterns in this experience.
Hmm. I would imagine that any trauma, what's the right word I'm looking for here? As she watched the news, you know, as she
right.
was here in this country, and all the things that she witnessed in this century, she died in 1964, but think of all the events that she saw, you know, through her life.
Sure.
It must have been traumatic every time something horrific was happening in the world.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I was too young, of course, to ever know the whole range of that. But again, there is an episode you may remember in my book where I watch her late at night watching news reports about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I remembered that distinctly, and I think that's part of exactly what you're describing, that she obviously had an apocalyptic fear.
Mm-hmm. We're so many of us have been so protected.
It's true.
Even though we can see all kinds of terrible things happening on the television.
Right.
24 hours a day. We're still so insulated.
It's true. It is one of the... It's just one of the bizarre virtual realities of living in the first world, where we have this amazing technology that brings us the news of these disasters, and we watch them, and, you know, it's easy to numb out. And I think as Americans, we have to work hard at not numbing out, at staying engaged. And there are many ways to respond, and there are creative and constructive ways to respond, no matter where you live in the United States. And I think we as citizens need to be doing that, because we are so lucky.
Our guest this afternoon is Peter Balakian. He's the author of Black Dog of Fate, An American Son Uncovers His Armenian Past. The book is the winner of the Penn Martha Albrand Award for the Art of the Memoir. It's now out in paperback from Broadway Books. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. So you have two children, Sophia Ann and James Gerard.
That's right.
14 and 10.
So yeah, my son's still 14. 9, but he's pushing toward 10. Yeah.
And what have you told your children, and what do they know, and how did that conversation go, or how does it go?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting issue, and my wife and I spent time mulling over the impact of my work on our kids, but finally you can't control too much of it. About a week after my book came out in hardback last April, my daughter had read it, so she was 13 at the time, and I felt it was, she was going to read it, I certainly wasn't going to stand in her way, and she's a very mature 14, and very bright and interesting. She has been interested in these issues, I guess, for several years now. I mean, when it is your work and when you're a teacher and you're sitting around the house watching video footage of the Holocaust or of the Armenian genocide, of Pol Pot's genocide, your kids are gonna pick it up. And we found that it was hard. You want to just have a democratic environment in your house and not forbid your children, if they're interested or curious. I'm very careful not to impose any of this on them. I remember when my daughter picked up Anne Frank's diary, she was in fourth grade, and I did a double take, and I talked with my wife about it, and we both said, well, that's okay. If, she's there, she wants to read it, and let her digest it as she will. So she has a pretty acute sense of human rights issues, and she has a great passion for things Armenian. She's 5/8 Armenian because my wife is a quarter Armenian. So she, she has an interesting perspective, but she embraces the Armenian stuff, and we're happy for that, but we try not to push anything. My son's a little young. He's just kind of beginning to, get into such things. He's a boy. You know how boys are.
9 going on 10.
Yeah.
Do you bake with them? Do you make the koreg? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, koreg. Yeah. It's funny. I don't bake much anymore, but I love to cook. So I cook, and my wife bakes with them. And she doesn't bake churek with them, but other things. And yet we, you know, I like to cook Armenian when I can, and the kids certainly hang around that. I mean, the kitchen is a place where families hang around. I think that's why kids pick up the whole issue of cooking. If you're a family that hangs around in the kitchen, like Armenian families do, and so many other cultures do, then good things are happening. And I it's an interesting way, you know, as a kid you don't realize it, but you're absorbing a lot of knowledge that way. Because I do believe food is a transmission of history and culture.
That's the way to everybody's heart.
Yeah, and even sometimes the soul and brain.
Well, tell us what choreg is. It's a sweet bread, but tell us more about what it is.
Choreg is you're the first person in 13 months of interviewing on the road who's asked me what choreg is. It's like a shortbread, so it's not it doesn't rise, or it rises very little, and it's a light. Oh, you know, it's somewhere between a bagel and a croissant. That's one of the best ways I could put it. If you can imagine such a hybrid, and it has
layers, but it's heavier than a croissant.
It doesn't have layers. It has bagel. It's they're often shaped like a bagel. They're round, circular with a hole in the middle, and they're glazed with a kind of an egg yolk on the top, so they shine when they come out, and they have some aromatic spicing in them. This wonderful thing called machleb, which is the spice of a cherry pit, ground up. It has this earthy fragrance to it, just a tinge. Sweet is exaggerating, but just wonderfully aromatic, perfumey like. And I would say like a croissant, because they have a slight light flakiness to them, even though they don't rise. And everybody should learn how to make it.
Yeah.
And the recipe's in my book.
And think of the I will always think of, whenever I have cherry now, I will think of your grandmother, I think, and the Song of Solomon.
Yeah, that's right. That's great. I'm glad.
We're here near the end of the time we can spend together today. I really wish you the best, and I hope your family is well and happy. And
thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us, and maybe one of these days we could talk with you about your work as a poet.
I'm happy to do that.
Okay.
I'll be in Chicago on July 9, so.
Oh, maybe. Okay. Well, we'll have to connect.
Good.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Celeste.
Peter Balakian has been our guest this afternoon. He is the author of Black Dog of Fate, An American Son Uncovers His Armenian Past. The book is now out in paperback from Broadway Books. Peter Balakian is professor of English at Colgate University and the author of four books of poetry, most recently Dyer's Thistle.